Wendy Ring.
And I'm Brian Curtis. Welcome to Cool Solutions, stories about climate action from the bottom up.
A couple of months ago, we did an episode about fossil fuel divestment at Harvard. And while we were doing that, we discovered something important.
The money pipeline flows both ways. It's not just universities investing in fossil fuel companies. Fossil fuel companies are investing in universities, too. For example, the Harvard Environmental Economics Program and the Harvard Project on Climate Agreements are funded by Chevron, Shell, and Duke Energy.
MIT's energy initiative is funded by Exxon, Chevron, Shell, and ConocoPhillips.
Princeton's carbon mitigation initiative is solely sponsored by BP, and their Andlinger Center for Energy and Environment is funded by ExxonMobil and investor-owned utilities burning coal, gas, and oil.
Climatologist and geophysicist Michael Mann compares fossil fuel funding for energy research to taking money from Russia to study American cybersecurity. It's putting the fox in charge of the henhouse.
But we're the hens.
Sitting ducks would be closer to the truth if we're waiting to be saved by the fossil fuel industry.
Ben Franta agrees. He's a lawyer who is currently working on a PhD in history at Stanford.
The very groups that are charged with coming up with the solutions are themselves dependent on funding from the industry causing the problem.
Judging from past behavior, the industry can't be trusted.
I study the history of the oil industry. I also work with climate change lawsuits. A lot of my work has to do with what is the history of fossil fuel companies? When did they know about climate change? What did they know? And what did they do about it?
Ben gives us a brief history of fossil fuel industry duplicity.
The oil companies became very aware of the climate problem by the end of the 1970s, beginning of the 1980s. Researchers have discovered internal reports from Exxon that show a very sophisticated understanding of the problem and predictions of how much warming will occur if business as usual continued, and the devastating impacts that would accompany that warming. When policymakers tried to enact fossil fuel controls to avoid those impacts, and this was late 1980s, early 1990s, when that process really ramped up, the oil industry created climate denial as a way to fight fossil fuel controls. By the end of the 90s, the industry changed its strategy away from overt denial and more towards vocally accepting the existence of climate change while working to oppose any legislation or regulations that would reduce fossil fuel use. And this was around the time when the oil industry started to create many partnerships with universities. That's when historically we see this ramp up in academic funding, promoting economic studies that exaggerated the cost of moving away from fossil fuels and ignored the cost of not doing so, and promoting solutions to climate change that maintained the dominance of fossil fuels. A lot of the climate-related research at Stanford is dependent on oil industry funding. And this has been the case for decades. So for example, the Global Climate and Energy Project that operated for about 15 years, that was mostly funded by oil companies. And now that's turned into something called the Strategic Energy Alliance, which is also mostly funded by oil companies. The Energy Modeling Forum, the Natural Gas Institute, heavily funded by fossil fuel companies as well.
What those industry dollars buy, in addition to greenwashing, is influence over universities' research agendas.
The major universities like MIT, UC Berkeley, Stanford, and so on, they advertise the fact that their corporate funders enjoy influence over the research that gets done. There are literally menus on these universities' websites that say, if you give us $1 million a year, then this is what you get. You know, at Stanford, the biggest climate-related research center on campus for more than a decade was funded mostly by fossil fuel interests. And all the funders had a representative on a management committee that had veto power over the research portfolio that was funded every year. So they had direct control over the research that was done or not done. And that's often how this influence operates. It's not the funders micromanaging a research project. It's them preferentially funding a certain area and not funding another. You know, as a historian, I can tell you that this is exactly what the tobacco industry did for years, funding research into causes of disease other than smoking. So it's that selective funding. That's what creates the bias in the research community as a whole, funding safe areas of research and not funding areas that might hurt the industry's bottom line.
When your bottom line is based on selling fossil fuel, that means finding a way to keep society buying it as long as possible.
Industry funding of ways to make that happen has an erosive effect on academic objectivity. Nobody wants to bite the hand that feeds them.
When Ben was at Harvard in the early days of the divestment movement,
almost all the faculty at Harvard were in support of divesting from fossil fuels. It was sort of a no-brainer. But the ones who were opposed to it tended to be funded by oil companies in their research. So they had this sort of conflict of interest, or at least a cognitive dissonance, where they had convinced themselves that these companies were positive actors and they felt uncomfortable taking any sort of public position against them. And often these professors worked in climate-related areas. I was a little bit surprised that there was this industry funding so prevalent in the climate research space. And then, of course, it worried me because it looked like it was creating a blockage in policy action.
Blockage in the form of billions of federal dollars diverted from solutions we know will work to dubious solutions based on burning fossil fuel. No doubt that's due to campaign contributions and lobbyists, but those lobbyists are wielding fossil-funded research from universities like Harvard and Stanford.
It should be transparent, and the public does deserve to know who is funding the research that we're all depending on to get us out of this global warming mess.
Selena Scott Buechler is another PhD student at Stanford.
My primary research is on climate policy, and I came to Stanford not thinking that I was going to be working on university-level politics. I have focused more of my work on federal and state.
She changed her mind after reading a New York Times article in which the dean of Stanford's new School of Sustainability solicited contributions from fossil fuel companies.
When this sustainability school was announced with just such blatant open invitations to industry partners, it just felt like a call to have this conversation.
The school's primary funding came from a single $1.1 billion non-fossil fuel contribution.
The second largest donation in higher education's history. Why do we need these couple extra $1,000s from fossil fuel companies?
When she started looking closer, Selena found the new school will fold in Stanford's existing energy programs, which are already dripping with fossil fuel dollars and focused on promoting fossil fuel-centric solutions.
I keep being surprised by just how obvious and how out in the open a number of these things are. The managing director of the Stanford Center for Carbon Storage and Stanford Carbon Initiative, Sarah Dawn Saltzer, was employed by Chevron for 25 years. Primarily what her work has been is to put carbon capture and storage on various fossil sources of emissions, which sounds great and dandy if it worked. But CCS has been the solution just around the corner for the past 20 plus years as the way that we could have our cake and eat it too, continue to rely on fossil energy and also be able to remove its emissions. And the sad reality is that that has not worked in practice. The 90% capture efficiency that experts like Sarah Saltzer like to tout has not been borne out in practice. She has repeatedly been called on by the California Air Resources Board that is making these decisions around how the state is going to achieve net zero emissions. So it's unsurprising that every time she's asked to present, her research shows a very rosy picture of CCS and high confidence that we should rely on it heavily. The Stanford Hydrogen Initiative is funded by Chevron, Shell, Phillips 66, GS Energy, SK Energy, and the co-managing director is also the managing director of the Natural Gas Initiative at Stanford and has held a variety of technical and management positions at Chevron. I think it's no mistake that the conclusion that this initiative comes to is that blue hydrogen, relying on fossil fuel sources to produce hydrogen, is kind of a viable climate solution.
Fossil fuels' influence on climate policy is aided by the revolving door between industry, academia, and government.
It's not just research papers come out of these research environments that end up then trickling into Congress, but that the very people who are industry funded develop these kind of mirages of expertise and objectivity. And so an Obama administration or a Biden administration is looking around wondering, who do we get to come in and work on renewable energy? Well, who's most published on some of these topics? Often industry-funded people. Sally Benson, who does a lot of CCS-related research and is openly taking fossil fuel funding, is currently working in the Office of Science and Technology Policy, OSTP.
It's an agency in the executive branch which advises the president on science and technology policy. Pretty influential place to be.
Arun Majumdar, the incoming dean who has ardently defended fossil fuel integration into the research ecosystem, was nominated under the Obama presidency for the position of Undersecretary of Energy.
So when she saw the sustainability school's new dean asking for more fossil fuel money, Selena felt compelled to act.
This New York Times piece, felt pretty furious, reached out to some friends. They reached out to some friends. They reached out to even more friends. And it's grown from there. We got the Graduate Student Advisory Council to work with us to put out an open letter that faculty, staff, and students signed. Colleagues have been willing and excited to sign such a letter. And interestingly, it has been more so on the faculty side, those who are untenured, those who are actually in a position of professional precarity because institutions decide what your future is at the institution. And if you don't play by their rules, then it is very, very easy for them to get rid of you when you are pre-tenure.
This is not a theoretical consideration. Continuing to burn fossil fuel means perpetuating environmental injustice for people living near power plants and freeways. And Selena told me about several current and former instructors who were relegated to staff positions or passed over for advancement as retribution for speaking up.
Next time around, we'll consider you for a real position. But for the meantime, just teach all of these courses that we need to have taught. We won't pay you very much, but under kind of the guise of, well, down the road. And so it has actually been shocking to me the number of risks that people who are early in their careers and looking around at them at this ivory tower that they have decided to become a part of, and shaking their heads at sort of the way that it is making these decisions, that those are the people with the most to lose and also those that are rising to the challenge. A lot of these junior faculty who are willing to sign on are also people of color. And so that puts them in greater precarity in an academic institution that has been primarily white and primarily men. And even still, their principles are strong enough such that they're willing to take all of these risks clear-eyed. And I have goosebumps right now. That's a tremendous, tremendous risk, greater certainly than the risk I have to take to be in this work.
Why would faculty who are secure in their positions not want to sign on?
You spend enough time in an institution and groupthink is overpowering. You see your colleagues who you have cocktail hours with, and they're funded by fossil fuels, and you know their kids, and you know their spouses, and they're nice people. So surely they must be objective scientists. They would not be spelling climate doom intentionally. And so it kind of becomes more about relationships than it does about political economy.
You're listening to Cool Solutions. We're talking with university students about the movement to ban fossil fuel funding from climate research. Sounds like a nerdy topic, but as you'll hear if you stick with us, it's affecting one of the biggest decisions about climate action being made today. How long can we keep burning fossil fuels? Stanford Sustainability School still has the chance to start from a position of integrity.
Because no commitments have been made, we're trying to make sure that commitments to fossil fuel partnerships don't get made. No decisions have been made so far that the dean would not be able to walk back himself. We've had several conversations with the dean and with other administrators, and they've said, no, that's unfair to just single out the fossil fuel companies. And so what we're doing now is creating a comprehensive set of guidelines for industry partnerships that require them to have made real commitments to sustainability in order to be a part of the sustainability school.
None of the school's current fossil fuel funders would meet any reasonable guideline for sustainability, since they're all still actively searching for more oil reserves, which is incompatible with global climate goals. Speaking of global, the Stanford Coalition is part of a growing international movement. Students and faculty at Harvard, Brown, Tufts, University of Wisconsin, Princeton, and Oxford and Cambridge in the UK are all working on kicking fossil fuel companies off campus. They have joined together as the Fossil Free Research Coalition.
At Cambridge, there's actually a BP Institute. After protesters briefly occupied the eponymous building, the university decided to change its name, but they still accept BP money for research on renewable energy.
Students say fossil fuel funding for any climate-related research is unacceptable, since it allows companies to greenwash their reputations for the price of a small donation, while donating 98% of their resources to political obstruction and fossil fuel expansion.
The most egregious example of fossil fuel-funded university research affecting climate policy comes from George Washington University's Regulatory Studies Center, known on campus as the RSC.
Exxon and Coke-funded faculty and affiliates have submitted public comments to the federal government on RSC's behalf, supporting Trump's rollback of fuel efficiency standards and repeal of the Clean Power Plan.
RSC research was cited by Trump's EPA in its decision to lower the social cost of carbon from the $45 a ton established under Obama down to $5 a ton.
The social cost of carbon is the dollar figure governments use when considering the costs and benefits of climate policies. It's the cost we all pay if we do nothing, which appears to be what the RSC wants.
A paper authored by the RSC's director was cited by Justice Gorsuch in his concurring opinion on West Virginia versus the EPA, the Supreme Court decision limiting the EPA's power to regulate greenhouse gas emissions.
We learned about that from Jake Lowe, an organizer for Uncoke My Campus, a national network active at 18 U.S. universities. He spent a semester researching the RSC, who they are, where their money comes from, and what they do. He looked into the background of its people, like director Susan Dudley.
In the early 2010s, she and colleagues at the RSC were writing stuff such as, "If it weren't for anthropogenic warming, Manhattan would be in a glacier right now." Susan Dudley's also said, "We need to remember that one of the benefits of smog is that less sun gets to us, which means there's less risk of skin cancer." Tony Cox is a really big name at the RSC. He's an RSC scholar with tons of ties to the fossil fuel industry. But it's really easy to sweep those under the rug with the Institute because you can just say they're a visiting scholar at the RSC and omit all those other ties. The Regulatory Studies Center, in partnership with the American Chemistry Council, helped fund his development of a statistical tool called CAT, or causal analytic technology. Sounds very fancy, but basically what it is he was able to make the statistics do the right things to make it look as though air pollution doesn't lead to mortality. And then he also later went on under Trump to be appointed to the head of Trump's Clean Air Scientific Advisory Committee, where he proceeded to scrap the evidence-based scientific process that committee had held for years prior. And that same tool, CAT, that I was talking about earlier, has been more recently used by Cox to say that air pollution doesn't increase the risk of getting COVID, which it does. I was beginning to lose faith in institutions to do something about climate change. So in that sense, I don't think the RSC was a surprise, but learning about it made me really angry. It definitely just makes me feel a little bit more embarrassed to go to school here. Also, in a weird backwards way, I feel lucky that this was happening on my campus because I have the ability to affect change here.
The Koch brothers have a fleet of foundations which make prolific grants to universities. I looked at just one tax return of one of their foundations for 1 year and found donations to 150 institutions of higher learning.
Bella Kumar is another student at George Washington. She got involved with Sunrise as soon as she hit campus.
I was a freshman, had just came to GW, saw these posters all over campus for this march on Congress. So I went to the first meeting. This is going to be an arrestable action. We're going to cross the Capitol border and we're probably going to get in big trouble. And I was at that moment, super angsty, like super pissed off. I was like, put me in cuffs. Let's do this. We marched on Congress. A bunch of us got arrested, got a lot of press. GW got mad. And so Sunrise really grew from that first action.
Now Bella's the coordinator of Sunrise at George Washington and their campaign to kick fossil fuel money off campus.
They started by writing a letter to the president of the university and collected 1,500 petition signatures, but they've also been putting pressure directly on the RSC.
We show up at nearly every single one of their in-person events with megaphones and our banner.
During the coalition's International Day of Action, while the students at Cambridge were occupying the BP building,
Jake and I snuck into the RSC and decorated their office. We put up our letter, all of our petition signatures. We printed out a bunch of these fake checks that say Regulatory Study Center, $3.5 million from Exxon, whatever, along with a bunch of other posters. We basically just like art bombed their entire front of the office.
They're also hitting this private university where it hurts by engaging with prospective students.
We jumped on tours to new students. We just like would join the tours and kind of hijack them and like just tell all the students, this is what's actually going on. The school takes a ton of fossil fuel money. They say all these things about academic freedom, but in reality, they're in the pockets of the fossil fuel industry. Keep this in mind when you're choosing a university. And if you do choose this university, come fight with us.
And they gave their own tour.
We started in Kogan Plaza, which is our quad, then went to the office of the dean, the president's house, the provost's office, and then we ended at the RSC, which is housed in the School of Media and Public Affairs. And at each stop, we had our actions and demonstrations captain, Rio, dress up as a UPS driver in like brown with like UPS logo and a UPS hat, deliver a letter to each of the people that we were going to go stop at. The goal was really just to have this big visual action, taking it to the university, which was fun. But we do big theatrical stuff and artistic stuff like that all the time. That's kind of Sunrise's MO. Having student support is great, but they're not really in a position to do anything about this. It's the people who produce the research that can do anything about this, and those are the professors. What we set up to organize our faculty is what we call the Fossil Free Organizing Corps, the FOC. We call the kids Fockers because it's funny and provocative. I crocheted a bunch of hats that say Focker across the top.
The FOX 30 members meet weekly to choose targets and plan strategy.
They're collecting pledges from faculty not to take fossil fuel money.
We group students by their majors and by their departments.
Once they get a faculty member to sign, they ask them to approach their colleagues. And when they have enough faculty in a department, they ask the whole department to make the pledge. Just like Stanford, it's been harder than they thought to get professors to take a public stand, even when they have no financial stake.
The American Studies Department does not take fossil fuel funding. That is my department. I know all of the professors. I have had probably 8 meetings with the department head alone. I've met with every single professor individually, and a bunch of other American Studies students have met with them individually as well. And we have not been able to get them to take the pledge. I found myself on so many occasions being like, why will these departments that are super lefty teach us about student organizing and teach us about rebelling against institutions and how corporations are bad? Why won't they take this stupid pledge and just say that they're doing this thing that they're already doing? Because they're scared of alienating themselves from the Trachtenberg School, from the RSC, because those are two very powerful institutions at GW.
So students decided to turn up the pressure with a poster blitz.
We made super American studies-y, things that professors would appreciate, kind of posters, and posted them everywhere. I mean, we knew our audience, right? We knew how we were going to persuade them. And one of the ways that we were going to persuade them is tell them that we're paying attention in class. So we took these old war on drug posters from the 60s and made them fossil fuel. So we have Dare to Say No posters that say Dare to Say No to Fossil Fuel Money, postered all over the big lecture halls, and it looks beautiful. We did actions. We showed up to their classrooms. We asked questions in class in front of all of these other students. We made it hard for them to not address it.
So far, several departments within GW School of Public Health have indicated that they will take the pledge, and the American Studies Department has agreed to take up the issue in the fall. While taking up causes at university used to be optional, for today's students, fighting for climate action is as important for their future as getting a degree.
I work 20 hours a week outside of school, and I'm taking 15 hours of class, and then I put every spare minute into Sunrise because I don't want our planet to explode. It's exhausting, unpaid, thankless work. It's hard, and everyone in Sunrise goes through the same cycle of burnout and picking up the pieces and picking up each other when we need to, but we are able to do it because of the community we build at GW, and I'm really lucky and happy to be a part of it.
Meanwhile, across the country, Stanford's Coalition for a True Sustainability School has collected more than 700 signatures on their open letter. And they've gotten national media coverage, shining a light on the role of fossil fuel companies at universities. The Stanford Fossil Free Research Group is not contemplating any occupations, art bombings, or student tour hijackings at the moment.
We're primarily climate researcher-led, primarily postgraduates and faculty. And so the way that we're trying to come about this is that we have expertise to lend, and we collectively have the academic standing to be able to point to the clear discrepancies in this planning. But of course, if and when those calls to reason are not heeded, we have other plans.
If they need ideas, they can call up Bella. In March of 2022, the U.S. and U.K. Fossil Free Research Coalition launched an open letter calling upon university presidents and vice chancellors to ban fossil fuel funding for climate, environmental, and energy research.
The letter has been signed by over 740 academics, including IPCC authors and Nobel Prize recipients, from more than 130 institutions. You've been listening to Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up. Thanks to our guests Ben Franta, Jake Lowe, Bella Kumar, and Selena Scott-Buechler.
And to Braver, Ketsa, Lobo Loco, One Man Book, and Scott Holmes for our music. For information on how to connect up with the fossil-free research movement, check out our website, cool-solutions.org.